Hi, I'm Kenneth Johnson. I am the next guest on Screen and Beyond.
On Screen and Beyond, an inside look into the entertainment world featuring interviews with people from the movie, TV, and music industry, news on upcoming TV and DVD releases, and the rumor mill. And now, here's the host of On Screen and Beyond, Brian Zemrak.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of On Screen and Beyond. I'm your host, Brian Zemrak. This is episode 552 of the show that keeps you updated on what's coming your way as far as upcoming new movies, remakes, sequels, and TV and movie DVD releases, as well as our interview segment with a guest from the movie, TV, or music industry. This week on Screen and Beyond, great guy coming your way, Kenneth Johnson. And he is a director, a writer, a producer, an author. He was a director of $6 Million Man, creator of V, the series. Remember that? And also the Incredible Hulk TV show. That's right. He created that. Alien Nation, the TV show, The Bionic Woman, and so much more. And Kenny is going to be with us in a few minutes right here on Screen and Beyond. So I hope you're going to stick around for that. And lots of things going on here. I had a computer crash, lost a lot of stuff trying to figure out how to get everything back together here. but still got a lot of listeners coming to On Screen and Beyond. Of course, some places I never even heard of. Åland, I guess. I don't know how you pronounce that. Up around Norway, somewhere between there in Finland, I guess. Somewhere up in that area anyways. And Australia, got a lot of people over there. Queensland and Victoria and New South Wales. Stateside, well, we've got Hollywood, Florida, Pompano Beach, Florida, and Fort Myers, Florida. Also, California people, a lot of people in California listening. It was some people in Fremont, and also Santa Monica, and also Santa Maria, Corona, Kinsburg, some places I never heard of. But anyways, appreciate you listening. I hope you'll keep listening to On Screen and Beyond. And the latest uploads, we've been putting them up left and right here. Every day I try to get at least one up there. And Robert Vaughn, Napoleon Solo from The Man from U.N.C.L.E., we put that one up. And Joe Mantegna of Criminal Minds, we have episode with him on it. Max Baer Jr., Jethro Bodine, hey, from the Beverly Hillbillies. What are you, it was a fun show having him on. And so many others, just so many others. I hope you keep listening to On Screen and Beyond. Tell a friend. We've got all our old episodes coming up, and weekly we put up a new show. So keep listening, subscribe. That's the best way to keep up with what episodes are coming your way, and whether they're the new releases or the re-releases that we're putting up. And if you just tell a friend about it, of course, that's the best way to get things out. And if you enjoy the show, please leave us a review or a 5-star review to help us get the word about On Screen and Beyond out there, because it helps a lot. And if you're on Instagram, you can get us now. We are at On Screen and Beyond Podcast, okay? And if you're on Twitter, you can get us at On Screen, the letter N, Beyond. Okay, that's because Twitter, you can only put so many letters and everything. So anyways, that's an update on what's coming your way, and we've got other things coming your way, of course, here at On Screen and Beyond, but let's get right into it. It's time for Remake Madness.
Please hang up and try again.
Remake Madness, well, the big screen remake of Jungle Cruise with Dwayne Johnson is going to be playing in theaters and on Disney Plus Premier Access, and that comes your way on July 30th. Jason Momoa, and he's scheduled to star in a remake of 1993's Cliffhanger, which originally starred Sylvester Stallone. And the remake of Masters of the Universe is listed right now as in production. So no word on when it's going to start filming, but we'll keep you updated. And that's it for Remake Madness. Coming up next on Screen and Beyond, upcoming new movies. Upcoming new movies. Ray Romano will be directing for the first time. It's a dramedy with no name at this time. And it's about a family in Queens, New York, and a boy who can change his life through basketball. And Bruce Willis and John Travolta will star in Paradise City. It is the first time in 27 years that they have worked together, and that was, of course, the last time in Pulp Fiction. And James McAvoy and Sharon Horgan will team up for a lockdown drama called Together. That's it for upcoming new movies. Next on Screen and Beyond, Sequel City. And what's coming your way as far as sequels?
Oh.
Sequel City, well, it looks like in 2016 it was announced that there would be a sequel to The Edge of Tomorrow, but now, according to Emily Blunt, one of the stars of that movie, says Edge of Tomorrow 2 may not happen due to the expense of making that film. Time will tell. And the film 365 Days on Netflix will be getting two sequels. The success of the steamy film has led Netflix to greenlight both sequels. And Catherine Hahn has joined the cast of Knives Out 2, joining Dave Bautista and Ed Norton and Daniel Craig. And filming starts soon in Greece. That's it for Sequel City. Coming up next on Onscreen and Beyond, what's coming your way as far as TV on DVD? TV on DVD, well, May 18th, The Ultimate Collection, Beverly Hills 90210, lands on DVD in a 74-set disc with all 10 seasons of the show, plus the first season of the 2019 remake of BH 90210. And also on May 18th, you can get CSI New York. It looks like the fans will be getting CSI New York, the complete series, with 197 episodes, 55 disc set with interviews and gag reels. And July 20th, Star Trek Discovery Season 3 flies on to Blu-ray and DVD. That's it for TV on DVD. Coming up next on Onscreen and Beyond, Movies on DVD. Movies on DVD, June 1st, Boogie hits Blu-ray and DVD, and No Man's Land with Frank Grillo and George Lopez arrives on Blu-ray and DVD, and it looks like Voyagers goes 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray and DVD on June 15th. And that's it for Movies on DVD. Coming up next on Screen and Beyond, TV and Entertainment Time. TV and Entertainment Time, well, some fan favorites on TV will be coming to an end soon. Mom is ending, Last Man Standing is ending, and now Blackish will end after Season 8, it was announced. And Nickelodeon, Legends of the Hidden Temple will be rebooted, but this time it will be on the CW. And Rebel has been axed by ABC. And that's it for TV and Entertainment Time. Coming up next on Onscreen and Beyond, well, this guy's going to bring back a lot of memories. He was the creator, the producer, the director of so many different shows. Kenneth Johnson's going to be joining us, the creator of V, the Incredible Hulk TV show, Alien Nation TV show, and The Bionic Woman. And he's going to talk about all of those and just give us some great information, a lot of fun. Kenneth Johnson is coming up next right here on Screen and Beyond.
On Screen and Beyond, we have as our guest a writer, a producer, a director, the creator of numerous hit TV shows, including The Bionic Woman, The Incredible Hulk, the V science fiction franchise, the Alien Nation TV show. He also has directed and produced many shows, and he also wrote for those shows, as well as The $6 Million Man, Short Circuit 2, and D3 The Mighty Ducks. It's Kenneth Johnson. Kenneth, welcome to On Screen and Beyond.
Hi, thank you, Brian, and do call me Kenny. My father was Kenneth, so I was always Kenny, usually spelled K-I-N-N-Y, Kenny, to my relatives in Arkansas, and that sort of stuck. So that's what my cast and crew and friends call me, at least to my face. Behind my back, you never know.
No, yeah, it could be something else.
That's right, and I'm sure it has been.
Well, Kenny, I am honored to have you on the show because you have done so many hit shows that people have just loved and continue to love because it seems like they keep coming back.
That's true. It's several of the things that I did sort of achieved an iconic status, which is very flattering. It's, I think it's rare when somebody is able to create at least one project or book or movie or TV show or something that achieves that sort of iconic status, and I've been really lucky to sort of have found the lightning in a bottle more than once, and and had the benefit of being surrounded by really talented people who made me look a whole lot better than I probably had a right to look. But it's been a fun time and continues to be.
Yeah. Well, we've had Lindsay Wagner has been on from The Bionic Woman,
and
Lee Majors was a guest here. So, we have some people who have actually worked with you. And,
that's right. And Lee came on and said, "Hi, I'm Lee Majors. I'll be the next guest on Screen."
Yes.
I saw Lee about a year and a half ago, the Hollywood Museum, Movie Museum down on Vine Street.
Yeah, yeah.
Was having a big, opening a big bionic exhibit, and they asked me and Lee if we'd come down. And Lindsay was filming something at the time and couldn't. And I hadn't seen him in, my God, I don't know, 25 years or more. And he was the same guy, man, that I work with, you know. Mm. He's like a little over 80 now, I guess that would be right. And but still fit as a fiddle and had the same sense of humor and a grin, and you know, and we had a great time just reminiscing about all the laughs we had and how he'd been concerned that Andre the Giant was going to drop him on his ass when he was walking through this rotating ice tunnel for the Bigfoot episode that I did on 6 Mil. And the thing I enjoyed the most, though, was at the very, very end, after all was done, and we'd set our, done everything and everything, and he was headed out to the car, and he was just about to get into the limo, and he looked over the top of it, and he said, "Hey, Kenny, don't let the old guy in." And I said, "I get it, Lee." You know, and he certainly hadn't. He was just as spry and fit and funny as he had been when we were working together in 1975 or
wow.
6, as it was.
Yeah.
And it was great. And Lindsay, I see usually at least once or twice a year we'll have lunch together, and she has remained just as vibrant and funny and sweet and touching and as she ever was. So we've had a good run together.
Yeah, it sounds, hearing you talk about this, it sounds like you had fun. It wasn't, it almost sounds like it wasn't work for you.
My grandmother said to me, "Kenny, if you find a job you love, you'll never work."
Mm-hmm.
and that's the way it really has been, Brian. I have been very, very lucky because it's like my hobby, you know. It's like I don't play golf and or anything like that, and I just this is what I love doing more than anything else. When I'm not on a set, I'm reading about it being on a set, or I'm reading about projects that I could maybe get my foot into, and so that I can get back on the set. Directing is what I really, really love the most of all. Because writing is great, obviously. And my pal Stephen Bochco, who had been a classmate of mine at Carnegie, and Steve was in the writing program there. I was in the directing program, and I never thought of myself as a writer really at all. I didn't think I was very good, particularly in the writing classes that we took then. And it was Steve that ultimately, when I first came out to Hollywood, really dragged me kicking and screaming into writing. He helped me to understand that if you were an actor, you could do bit parts and work your way up, you know, and if you were a writer, you could write on spec and maybe somebody would hire you or buy your script and maybe let you direct it even, you know. But if you were just presenting yourself as a director, they either gave you the money to do it or they didn't, and usually they didn't until you'd done it for somebody else. So it was, you know... So that's how I fell into writing. I discovered I could write, and I could write pretty fast and with a fair amount of quality. And I always tried to write as fast as I could so that I could get onto the set as fast as I could. And it always really was like, and it still is to this day, it's like I'm always like a kid in a candy store. As soon as I get on my set with my cast and my crew and the whole team trying to collaborate to create a filmed project, we all look at each other very often and just giggle at the fact that we are where we are and we are able to do what we do, and we appreciate it every single moment because it's I remember there were a couple of times, 15 years or 20 years ago, when I'd get really angry and upset on a set one day and frustrated and, you know, things weren't going right or stuff, people hadn't delivered what they were supposed to, and I was angry. And I, at the end of the day, I said, I don't ever want to have another day like that on the set. I got to remember that every day I'm on the set could be my last day. And would I want to remember it as being that way, you know? And ever since then, I just, no matter what disaster befalls us in the middle of shooting, I just sort of take a deep breath and try to hold on to my sense of humor and move forward. And the years at Universal, particularly doing the shows with Lee and Lindsay, and I got myself in the door, incidentally, at Universal, thanks to my pal Steve Bochco, who had preceded me to California by a couple of years and helped me get my foot in the door there. And all of us sort of treated it like graduate school with pay, Brian. It really was what it felt like, because it was really like on the job training. And I remember when and I was only really interested in features in movies, in long form stuff, but I fell into TV because I could get a job, and it was Harve Bennett, whom Steve introduced me to, that invited me to join the $6 Million Man after I had created the Bionic Woman for him. Just as an outside writer, I came in. We needed some script ideas, and that's how that happened. And Harve wanted me to join $6 Million Man as a writing producer. He had one other producer on the series, and he needed another writing producer. And I said, I don't want to do that, Harve. Let me just write and direct for you. I said, producing is a pain in the ass. And Harve said, yeah, but let me explain it to you, Kenny. The producer is the guy at the top of the pyramid. The producer is the guy that hires the writer and hires the director. I said, stop, Harve. That's a job I would be happy to take, you know, and which is the way that I managed to get myself into it. And then there I was suddenly in the midst of becoming a producer of one-hour episodic television, which Harve also convinced me was the greatest. I remember him saying, Kenny, producing and writing and directing episodic television is the greatest training in the world for making movies or for waging war. You know, and he's right, because when you can, but to put it in perspective, somebody makes a movie, they'll spend 9 months or a year doing one project that's about 2 hours long, more or less. Mm-hmm. When you're doing a one-hour episodic television show, in 9 months, you're expected to do 22 hours of film. So it's a bit like living in a garbage disposal, Brian. But at the same time, it really... You either learn or you're suddenly not there anymore. But we always looked at it as great fun, and never got tired of the fact that we were in a state of grace, as one of my actor friends once said. She also was always cheerful on the set and always just a great energy to be around. And I said, how do you do it? And she said, Kenny, we're in a state of grace. I mean, who else gets to do this stuff? And I know that Bochco felt that way. My other dear friend, Steve Cannell, whom Steve Bochco introduced me to, was also a young writer at Universal at the time. It was just before he wrote a script that he sent me to read while I was there, and it was called The Rockford Files, you know. It was a new pilot that he was doing, and I said, God, this is great, but I got to tell you, man, that it jumps out at me. I think you ought to take it to Jim Garner. And he got this quirky little smile on his face and said, it's already in his hands. And we were all, you know, so we called ourselves kind of the class of 1980 at Universal Studios. There was an article done in the Writers Guild magazine about that very thing, and myself and Steve and Don Belisario and a couple of the others who were at Universal at the time, and it's on my website, kennethjohnson.us, in one of the articles where they really sort of did a study of those of us who were at Universal and sort of were the class of 1980 at the Universal Studios University, you know.
You know, and just between you and the three names that you just threw out, I mean, that was television. I mean, that's those names came up for the next 20 years.
Yeah. We were all just starting out. Botchko was a fledgling writer on a slave contract, like I was when I first started at Universal. Steve Cannell was a story editor on a show called Adam 12, a half-hour cop show with Marty Milner and Kent McCord, which he got me a couple of writing gigs on, and also a directing gig, bless his heart. So, you know, we all worked with each other all the way along there, and Botchko also was helpful. But, it was a very energized place, and Glenn Larson was also, of course, there at the time.
There's another name.
Another name that, you know. But you see, all of those guys, Steve and Glenn and Steve Cannell and later Phil Daguerre, were all writers. Mm-hmm. You know, and they loved it. You know, they reveled in it. I mean, Cannell would get up at 5 in the morning and write pages and pages and pages before he even got to the office. And Botchko was equally fast. And I was fast, but I didn't have the facility and the writing chops, I never thought, that either of them had. And also, I just didn't like it as much, Brian. It was not as much. When you're writing, you know, it's very insular. You're in a room, and if you don't have a writing partner or a writing staff that you're developing things with, it's all on your shoulders, and it's really hard.
Yeah.
Whereas directing, to me, is like breathing. it's also a more sensual experience, in the sense that I can touch you, Brian. You know, and the people that are around me, we can be a team, and you're physically there in the room with me. In addition to bringing your talents, whether they're lighting or costume design or production design or whatever, but we're there talking, we're kicking ideas, we're going back and forth, and we're in vans going to look at locations. I mean, you know, that's just the best.
Yeah, sounds like fun. And now, how did you come up with the, I mean, obviously the idea of the Incredible Hulk was already out there, but how did you develop that into a show? Did you just say, well, this sounds like, you know, I could make something out of this? Or how did that work?
Well, I had first met Harv, and he was in the first full season of $6 Million Man. It had been a mid-season replacement, so they were starting their first full season, and they were apparently really desperate for scripts. And this was in a time when there were not huge writing staffs and writing rooms as they seem to have now, you know. And 45 producers who aren't really producers but really writers, but they give them a producer title so that they'll write for them, you know, that kind of thing. It was just a very small handful of people. And an outside writer, and outside writers would come in and pitch ideas to us. And Botchko had given a feature script that I had written to Harv Bennett, which Harv really, really liked. And I said, I can't help you get it produced, but I like your writing and I like the characters. Can you write something for $6 million? And I suggested The Bride of Frankenstein, the idea of a bionic woman. Mm-hmm. And he liked that. And as we worked together on it, he really took me under his wing because he realized I had some producing chops. I had already had a fairly successful career in New York and as a writer, as a producer-director in live television. And then for 2.5 years, I was a producer and then executive producer of a thing called The Mike Douglas Show, which was the only daytime talk show back in those days.
Yep.
So I knew how to get stuff together and make it happen. And when I came to California, of course, and said, okay, here I am, ready to make movies, Hollywood said, no, you're a talk show producer. And I said, oh, shit. And that's when Botchko, I was literally sleeping on his couch when I first came out here. And he said, Kenny, you got to write. If you write, you can control your own destiny. And he literally dragged me kicking and screaming to it. But I did, and I discovered that I could write and could write pretty fast. That led to a bunch of unproduced screenplays that are still on my shelf, Brian. And also, to me, being able to go into Harv, who liked the script that I had read and then liked my idea for The Bionic Woman. And as I was fashioning the script and putting it together and we were working together, he really took me under his wing, took me into the editing room, took me with me, showed me what it was like to do the day-by-day process. And that's why he's lured me into becoming a writing producer, with the idea that I could eventually hire myself to write and, most importantly, to direct. which is what I did. And because The Bionic Woman really energized the whole $6 million man franchise. When we did the first two-parter, it just took everybody's heads off, and they were crushed when Lindsay died at the end of it, which I had not been in my script. I didn't want to do it that way. But Frank Price, who was running Universal, said, no, we want to do Love Story, Ken. We want a dead, right? So she was a big mistake, and then later, you know, the letters started pouring in from fans, and also they noticed the ratings were enormous, and they said, you know, we really need to bring her back. Why'd you kill her anyway, Kenny? So I had to bring her back, and then suddenly they wanted to spin it off into a separate series. So there I was now, the guy that really just wanted to direct, and I found myself in a position of writing and producing two shows, and, you know, there are guys that love that stuff, but I didn't want to do that, but I did it for the first year, and by then, you know, two garbage disposals at the same time is just too much. Because of the success of Bionic Woman and how much Six Mil had come into the top 10 since I had been producing on it, Frank Price called me one day and said, Ken, we've just acquired the rights to some of the Marvel comic superheroes. Which one would you like to do? And I said, none of them, Frank. Because it was like the Human Torch and the Man from Atlantis and Ms. Marvel and Captain America and this other ludicrous thing about this green guy, you know. And I said, Frank, I'm just not into primary colors and spandex. And he said, well, I'd really like you to think about it, you know, because they saw that I'd been successful with this one larger-than-life character in the Bionic shows. I was at home at night that night, Brian, really trying to think of how I could say no politely to the head of Universal, you know, because I just didn't want to do it. But I was reading a novel that my wife, Susie, had read when she was, I think 18, and I had never read, called Les Miserables. So I was in the moment, I had the idea of the fugitive concept, Jean Valjean being pursued by the Inspector Javert, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I had this churning in my head, and all of a sudden I realized, I suppose I could take a little bit of Victor Hugo and maybe a little bit of Robert Louis Stevenson's Jekyll and Hyde and this ludicrous thing called The Incredible Hulk and turn it into a serious psychological human adult drama, not a comic book kind of show. So I went back to Frank. I said, all right, let me look at that comic book. And the only thing I took from the comic book, he turns green and when he gets angry and that's about it, you know. And it was gamma rays. Okay.
Yeah.
And so I went to Frank and I said, all right, look, I will. And Bochco actually encouraged me to do it this way. He said, look, if you don't like what they're throwing at you, tell them you'll do it, but what will they give you in return, right? So I went to Frank and I said, okay, look, let me give you my idea for how to do the Hulk. And I pitched basically exactly what you saw in the original two-hour movie. And he said, okay, this is great. And I said, it has to be my casting. I don't want some Universal guys shoving an actor down my throat that I don't think is right, because that happened a lot in those days. And he said, no, it'd be your casting. It'll be you. We'll just leave you alone, let you do it. And so I said, okay, that's good. Very good. And I shook hands. And I said, wait. Before we shake hands, Frank, I want something in return. Okay, sounds good. What do you want? And I told him that I didn't think that Sir Walter Scott's novel, Ivanhoe, which is a great swashbuckling novel of knighthood and chivalry, and Robin Hood is one of the supporting players in it, you know. And it's about this young knight. It's like a Luke Skywalker kind of tale, you know. But it really was set in the 11th, 12th century. And I said, I really would love to do a miniseries of Ivanhoe. Frank said, okay, you got it. You do The Incredible Hulk, we'll do Ivanhoe. Boom. I jumped in and started, and I wrote the pilot script for The Incredible Hulk, 125 pages, in 7 days, from start to finish, in longhand on my yellow legal pad.
Wow.
And the really interesting aspect of it is that we shot what we call the white pages of my first draft. When the script comes in, it's the first draft, it's on white paper. As soon as you start making changes, it goes to different colors so that everybody can track the new color changes. And the Hulk script didn't have any colored pages in it. It was all white.
Wow.
and actually, the same can be said for the when I wrote the pilot of Alien Nation, and also V, for that matter, too. We really, in all three cases, shot the white pages of my first draft screenplay with just changes that I made myself for production as we went along, or some lines I would think, you know, think could be a little better here and there. But basically, that's what it was. And that's what happened. We just rolled right into production. Frank loved it. CBS loved it, and Stan Lee was 100% behind it. I had met Stan briefly beforehand, but on other things. But he really liked what I was doing. He understood why I wanted to change the name of Bruce Banner to David Banner, because I was trying to get away from the comic book kind of Lois Lane, Lex Luthor, Peter Parker alliteration, you know,
mm-hmm. yeah.
which always just screams comic book to me. And to try to make it as real as I could. And the one and only actor that I sent it to was Bix. I had seen Bill Bixby. I'd known him. I met him a couple of times previously, just in on a couple of other shows that I had done. Maybe he might have done the Douglas show or something, but we never got to really know each other. But in 1973, I saw him do a TV play on PBS called Steam Bath. And if you've never seen it, you should get it. It's available on Netflix, and it's about this group of people that find themselves in a steam bath that they don't seem to know how to get out of. There doesn't seem to be an exit. There's just them, and then there's this strange little Puerto Rican steam bath attendant, you know, who talk like that, man, you know? and slowly they begin to realize that this is not just a steam bath. This is like purgatory. And the little steam bath attendant is God. And in this 90-minute television play that I saw Bix do, he went through every single emotion that you later saw in all of the episodes of The Incredible Hulk. He did it all in 90 minutes. I mean, it was dazzling. And
wow.
So there I was 4 years later writing the script for The Incredible Hulk, and the first and only name that ever came into my mind was Bix because of that performance. And he told me that his agent gave him the script, and Bill said, I don't even want to read a script that's called The Hulk. I mean, please, forget it, you know. And his agent said, you want to read it, Bix. Okay, just read it. So he read it, and he called me the next day and said, hey, can I come see you? And he came into my office. I always used to say that Bill didn't just come into a room. He came into a room like the first eight bars of Tiger Rag. You know, it was like, here I am now, you know. And he was a force of nature.
Wow.
And he just said, I love this. Are we really going to do it like this? Is it going to be real? Is it going to be human drama? Is it going to be psychological suffering? And I said, yes, yes, all of that. And he said, will you stay with the show as long as I'm with the show? And at that point, I think I've said before that I sort of remember hearing faintly the sounds of the music of Faust playing in the background, you know. And is this my bargain with the devil here, you know? He seems like a nice guy, but what's underneath, you know? But I took a deep breath and said, yes, I will. And that's how it was. And we had an amazing 5 years together, and never a moment of nonsense or bullshit. We had a lot of arguments. Oh my God, we had a lot of knockdown, dragout arguments, but they were always about something. It was about a line. It was about a character. It was about a nuance or a theme that we're exploring. It was never about, you know, I have the vapors and I'll be in my trailer
right.
drinking or something, you know. It was just the best possible your relationship you could have, and with Jack Colvin on board as Jack McGee, who was just a brilliant actor and a wonderful adjunct to the show, and how Louis Ferrigno really grew into the role from a guy that had never done any acting at all. I mean, he was a bodybuilder, and he was 24 years old, you know.
Wow.
And he was from Brooklyn, and he was deaf, you know.
Yes, yeah.
But Louis used to say to me, Kenny, why doesn't The Incredible Hulk have more dialogue? And I said, well, Louis, for starters, he didn't come from Brooklyn, you know. And when we were first working together, because he was deaf, as so many people who are deaf, their voices are hard to understand sometimes. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yeah. But I didn't want the creature in the script. He never said anything. I didn't want to go to the Hulk smash dialogue of the comic books because it's like, duh, we can see that Hulk is smashing, you know. And I just wanted to avoid that kind of Frankenstein food good, yeah. you know, kind of dialogue. So that's how it happened. And then I was very lucky to bring on board with me Jim Parriott, who had been a writing producer with me on the Bionic shows, and is still one of my closest friends to this day. And then later on, Nick Correa came on board, and Karen Harris and Jill Sherman, who wrote their very first script in the business, I think, for me, which I had to rewrite entirely because it just was not good. But then they came back a little bit later and said, hey, we'd like to bring you another idea. And I said, oh, God, really? Because I had taken the time to sit down with them and go through and say, okay, look, you're going to get your script and you're going to say, what happened to what we wrote for you? And I want to explain to you why I changed what I changed and what the reason I did, you know? And they really listened and were appreciative. And then they came back, as I said, a couple of weeks later and said, we got another idea. And I thought, oh, great. But it was a really good idea. And they wrote it up, and it was good. And I said, okay, go on to the script. And their script was still a little fixing here and there, but it was good. And the next season, I hired them to be the story editors on the show. And the season after that, I moved them up to executive story consultants so they could get some more money. And then the year after that, I made them the producers on the show. And it was a great I always love being able to help lift people up like Harv helped and lifts me up, you know.
Yeah.
And it really paid off because they were we had a terrific set of people that were working on the show with me throughout.
Yeah. And V was I just loved that show. I mean, it was a mini series to begin with, but it was one of those things that after it ended, it was like, boy, I wish there was more. And of course, then you made
yeah,
more.
Yeah, there was. Unfortunately, I wasn't around for the subsequent stuff. The way that I had read Sinclair Lewis's novel, It Can't Happen Here, which we've been hearing a lot about in the last few years, actually,
right.
That novel. Because it was about a rise of fascism happening in America the way that it had happened in Italy and Germany. And this was, as I said, the book was written in 1935 or 6, I think, with the idea of, well, it's America, it can't happen here, you know. And, of course, it does. And I was really struck by it. And I thought, God, it would be great to do a piece about a sea change in our lives, about what happens when there is suddenly a huge sea change, because there hadn't been one, Brian, at that point since 1941, you know, since Pearl Harbor was attacked. That was a sea change, December 7th. The world changed for America, you know.
Yeah.
And until 9/11, we never experienced another one like that, until maybe January 6th of this year when the Capitol was overrun. But all of those are you know, such monumental moments. So I wanted to sort of explore the idea of how America would react. Everyday people, not generals and presidents, but how everyday folks reacted to when there was a sudden sea change, when suddenly an uber power rolls into your life, like the Nazis rolled into the Low Countries in Europe and said, "Hi, we're the new guys in town. We're here to be your friends because the English are going to mine the English Channel. You know, we will help you protect you from them." You know, and slowly they revealed their other face, their darker face,
mm-hmm.
as it were.
Yeah.
And that idea intrigued me, and that's where the notion of V came from. And my initial concept was a realistic human drama that did not have any spaceships or aliens or anything like that in it. It was a homegrown fascist uprising in the United States. Like, it really got uncomfortable in the last year, as we've seen in this country. And that's why people started talking about Sinclair Lewis's novel more and more. And I was in the midst of working on it when Brandon Tartikoff and I had dinner one night, and he was then the president of NBC, and I'd done a couple of other shows for him and projects together. And he asked what I was talking, and I mentioned this, and he said, "God, that would be great. Oh, I want to read it." And I said, "No, that's not for television, Brandon. I'm really trying to. I see this as a movie." So let me read it. And he read it, and he just flipped out, and he said, "Look, this is great. We can do it. Let's do a. Can we do a big mini series or something?" And I said, "Sure. I wouldn't say no." But he didn't think that the Americans maybe would get fascism, which maybe they still don't, and suggested that it should be an outside force that occupied us, like the Nazis, the Soviets or the Chinese. And I just didn't think that would sustain. I didn't think they could sustain a protracted occupation of the U.S. And then I think it was his vice president, a guy named Jeff Sagansky, who later went on to run several networks and several studios, who was at that point, he was a young MBA out of Harvard, you know. And he said, "How about aliens, Kenny?" And I thought, no, God, man. I went through being the game show producer, and then I got to be the superhero producer and writer. And now, I don't want to, the pigeonhole, Brian, gets smaller and smaller, you know.
Yeah.
I always tell my film students, be careful what your first success is, because that's what they'll want you to do for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
But Brandon really loved the idea, and he said, and I said, "No, I don't know. I'm so tired of aliens and stuff." And they just think about it. And I went home that night, and I did think about it, and I thought, it's a really brilliant idea, because I can tell the story that I want to tell, because the story I wanted to tell was about power, and about how people reacted to power coming into their lives, something with power, the Nazis, the alien forces, whatever, and how some people would suck up to them and collaborate like the Vichy French did in World War II with the Nazis.
Yeah.
Others would say, you know, if I keep my head down and I go along and don't make any waves, maybe they won't take me away or conscript me, and particularly if I'm not Jewish, or in the case of the of V, the scientists, they represented the Jews in World War II. And then there were the other group of people, of course, are the resistance people who say, no, wait a minute, this power is being abused, and we need to fight back against it, and to the extent of giving our lives if we have to. And I thought, that's really cool. And that's the story that I wanted to tell, which I realized I would absolutely be able to tell in all of the nuances that I had wanted to use. But I would have the additional eye candy, if you will, of the visualizations and the spaceships and the fact that I can literally have them show a different face to us by ripping off the face that they have.
Right, yes.
And so I could work in metaphor, which is, I think, one of the joys of doing speculative fiction or dealing with characters that are one step beyond reality, is that you really are sort of working in mythological kind of terms and metaphoric terms. And I think it was that underlying substance that really caught fire. And I think, Brian, to go back to what you said at the very beginning about the shows that I have done that have sort of become iconic, I think the reason that's happened, as I look back, is that I always tried to have the things that I was doing, the projects that I was doing that were commercially successful, have an artistic and substantive underpinning, so that there was a layer of substance underneath what was going on.
Yeah, definitely.
And, when The Incredible Hulk went on the air, you know, people and even a lot of the critics at the beginning thought, well, this is a comic book show. Kids are going to like it.
Right, Batman.
But what happened was, kids tuned it in to begin with, maybe a little bit, but it was. But that's part of the reason I wanted to have my own casting, because I wanted a really respected actor, television star like Bixby, that would draw in all of those adult people to say, well, wait a minute, if Bill Bixby's in this, you know, it can't be all bad, you know, it can't be all childish. And then they would tune in. So what happened was, very quickly, the kids would be watching, but the adults said, oh, wait a minute, there's something going on here.
Right.
You know, this story is about the demon within you, you know. And it was true. And then I brought that same kind of sensibilities to V, and later on to Alien Nation.
Yes.
Which was, you know, when Fox first talked to me about Alien Nation, They just asked me if I'd look at the movie, which had not been a successful movie, and I had not even seen it. And I went over to, I said, no, I don't want to even think about something that's called Alien, okay? I'm done. I'm tired of that. But they said, well, just come see it. And I went, and I'm sitting in the screening room, and I'm watching what I think I've characterized it as Miami Vice with Coneheads. You know, it was trying to be a cop show, but then we got this funny guy, and he drinks sour milk to get drunk. But it was, they were just sort of, I was really kind of bored. And about halfway through the movie, I was sitting alone in the screening room over at Fox, and this one scene came up when we got one glimpse for just one shot in the whole movie of the family of our alien cop, which is, and you just saw a shot of on the porch of this little alien woman and her two alien kids, and the bell went off in my head, and I said, wait a minute, who are they? What's it like to be them? What's it like to be, say, Vietnamese living in Galveston, Texas in 1974? You know, what's it like to be the latest minority off the boat? And I went back to Fox and to the executives, and I said, okay, you think you got Lethal Weapon with aliens? And they said, yeah. I said, no. I said, what I can do here is In the Heat of the Night. I can do a piece that's about prejudice and discrimination. And where'd you get a name like Virgil, boy? You know, and that's something that we can, that will have legs, because it's about something. The picture, like V, was about power. Alien Nation was about intolerance and about prejudice and discrimination. There was a lot of that in V, too, as a matter of fact. And a lot of that stems from my upbringing, because I was raised in a very virulently anti-Semitic, bigoted household where I heard every racial slur at dinner every night you would ever hear. And this was just from upper, I wouldn't even say upper middle class, basically middle class family. And just me, I was an only child. But somehow I knew it was wrong, Brian. I just didn't buy it. And so wherever I have been able to throughout my career, I have tried to chip away at that kind of intolerance and discrimination and put it in the forefront so that we don't forget that we should not be that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So anyway, that's sort of the long story version of it.
Well, Kenny, I wanted to mention TV shows now are not like they were back then, just the whole format of them. But one of the biggest shows that's out now that I've watched, it when I watched it the first couple of episodes, I said, this reminds me of the Hulk, not in the sense of you know, the creature and all that stuff, but each week they went on a little adventure, and then, you know, the next week it's another one, and they're all working toward a certain end. And I find The Mandalorian to be very much like that.
No, really? Okay.
It, to me, it seems like, you know, they watched, you know, your shows and are bringing back that type of TV, as opposed to, you know, the way things have been for the last...
Yeah, I did see a couple of episodes. I was curious at the beginning. I don't watch actually much TV at all, Brian. I really never have. But you know, I see what you're talking about, you know, in that. And I think that's admirable when people can find ways to speak to the basic nature of humanity and find a ways to get those things, you know, on the screen whenever possible. I thought also that, you know, I saw a few episodes. I haven't stayed with it again because I just don't follow TV much. But when I saw a couple of episodes of Stranger Things, and I thought, boy, this really feels like the stuff we were doing in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in a good way, you know.
Oh, yeah.
In a good way. And because it was, it had that magical Spielberg touch of commercialism with underlying artistry, which is what I have always sought to emulate as much as I can myself, to have stuff that can be artistically pleasing and satisfying to my own soul, and at the same time be commercially viable and draw people in. And it's funny how, you know, you don't set out I never got into this business, Brian, to make money or to have fame or fortune or any of that. I never even thought about that. I only cared about the theater, and I intended it originally just to be in the theater, because I loved it. I loved it, and when I went into Carnegie, it's now Carnegie Mellon. It was then Carnegie Tech, the drama department at Carnegie. It was then and still is one of the premier departments of drama in the country, and it was all theater. It was no film or TV. It was all theater. But I was lucky enough in my very first week of my freshman year to meet a guy that really changed my life. He was not a dramat. If you were in the drama department, you were called a dramat. Bill was in a business major, something like that. I discovered he was a big man on campus because he ran the school newspaper, the college newspaper. He ran several of the other major organizations on the student organizations on the campus, and he also ran this thing called the Film Arts Society, where he screened a classic movie every week, a different movie every week for $3. You got 14 films a semester, I'd been a movie fan since I was a kid, of course, but Bill introduced me to the cinema, to introduce me to the classics, the foreign classics that I had not seen, the silent classics that I had never seen. I suddenly realized, wow, this is amazing. Bill, incidentally, his last name is Pence, Bill Pence. He and his wife went on to create the Telluride Film Festival.
Oh, yeah.
And ran it for 35 years. And I always call Bill the godfather of my film career because I realized that when you have a wonderful moment in the theater, and we've all had those where it's just it's staggering. You'll see something on the stage and it's magical. But once the curtain comes down and the lights come up, it's gone. It's in your memory, but you can't revisit it. However, if you can capture it on film, then you got it. And I think that's part of the reason that I love movies and television films so much, is because once you've got it, Bill Bixby is just as alive today as he was then. All the people who did V with me and Alien Nation just won't age any more than Bogart did when he did Casablanca,
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, is when I was looking up stuff on you for this interview, I happened to see a picture on the internet of you standing next to a person and then one of the actors from V, and it was Mickey Jones. I don't know if you remember him.
Oh, sure, I know Mickey well, sure.
And, and Mickey was actually the first guest on Screen and Beyond.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh.
So I was surprised to see it. But, Kenny.
Mickey was great. We worked together on a couple of things over the years.
Yeah,
and,
he's a nice guy.
Yeah, he was a dear guy, a good friend.
Yeah. Well, Kenny, I'd like to finish up. I know we had talked before we got on the air, and excuse me, and like you said, we could go 14 days just talking about, because there's so many other things we could go over, but I know, we don't have that much time. So,
right.
But I'd like to finish up with a question that takes us away from all the TV shows, the great TV shows that we all enjoyed and still are enjoying. But when you sort of answered this a little bit, but when you sit back and relax, what are your favorite TV shows now and of the past? And what are your favorite movies now and of the past?
Well, when I remember back on television, and the television that I watched particularly before when I was a kid, Hitchcock, the Alfred Hitchcock Presents really jumped out at me.
Yeah.
I was just amazed by the irony and the quality, of it, and the storytelling. Later on, I obviously became a fan of the Twilight Zone and the work that Rod Serling was doing, very much in the same vein that I have tried to work, where he was playing. There was a lot of depth going on with Rod, in all of Rod's stuff. I met him. He came to Carnegie one day, and I met him there. And then years later, we got to know each other really pretty well out here in California. And the work that he had done had been a big impact on me. In terms of movies. In terms of contemporary TV now, I really can't speak to it that much just because I just don't watch that much of it. Although I really enjoyed The Wire, which I discovered in its last season, and I thought the writing was and the performances were just so incredibly compelling that it just took my head off. And a lot of the early Sopranos work, I think, was the was the same way. In terms of movies, it's always pretty easy for me to point to my favorite movie. because people say, well, of all the movies, and well, there's so many. Well, where do you start? Well, to me, if anybody ever has the opportunity to sit down and watch the original Akira Kurosawa Seven Samurai, which is like 3.5 hours long, and you feel like you've been in the theater maybe an hour and a half, because it's so completely compelling. But it is a masterwork of humanism. And it also is a masterwork of filmmaking because it literally, The Seven Samurai contains everything. There is drama, there is humor, there is romance, there is love, there is extraordinary action sequences, there is cinematography that just in black and white is astonishing, and there are performances by Akashi Tomura as the principal samurai, and of course Toshiro Mifune as Kyucho, and it's a movie that I never get tired of it. I have taken, at one point, I literally went through it on an old reel-to-reel video machine, frame by frame, to see every single, and why did he make the cut here, and what's he doing here, and why did he, and it is just a masterwork of work, and I think in many ways a lot of the work that Peter Jackson did later on the first Rings trilogy and all was equally astonishing in its use of cinematography and its use of character and its use of color and its use it was just wonderful. I was listening to the music from it the other day and thought, God, I got to go see that movie again. So those are a couple of the particular standouts for me anyway.
Well, Kenny, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time to talk to us here, and I also personally want to thank you for all the entertainment and the shows that you have given us over the years, and I really do appreciate you.
Well, bless your heart. I so appreciate what you say, Brian, and as I say, it's been fun, and it was also fun recently to jump into novels. I fortunately had a novel a couple of years ago that became a bestseller called The Man of Legends, which was not an autobiography. But it's a book that really has a lot of breadth and depth to it, and became a fortunately kind of an instant bestseller and continues to do very well on Amazon. It's out there, and my website, people can see more stuff about me and what I'm doing. But what I've always tried to do, Brian, is to keep in mind, and the thing that I try to pass along to all of my film students is to try to emulate the people that have the most humanism in them, which is what Akira Kurosawa personifies. So do people like Spielberg and Ronnie Howard and Peter Jackson and Guillermo del Toro.
Yes.
I was in an evening with him at the Directors Guild last year, and it was just breathtaking to sit there with this real guy who's a real guy and has got so much humanity in him that you just want to get up and hug him, and that's how I feel about the work that I do, and I love to reach out and hug my fans whenever I can too, and I deeply appreciate the kindness that the viewing public and the reading public have given me over the years, and the encouragement, particularly also from people like you, and I appreciate you giving me the chance to be on screen with you, and we'll have to talk some more when you'd like to.
Kenneth Johnson, thank you so much for joining us here at On Screen and Beyond. I'm sure a lot of you have grown up with all those shows that he talked about, and if you haven't, you can go back and watch them now. They're streaming, I'm sure, all over the place, and we thank him so much for joining us and talking with us, and hopefully we'll get him back here another time to talk about more stuff right here on Screen and Beyond. So that's about it for this episode. We've got a lot of things coming your way, more guests coming your way, and just keep subscribing to On Screen and Beyond. That's the best way to get every episode that is coming your way, and you won't miss out on it or have to go back and look through every single episode that we have, because once we get them all back up there, all 552 of them, then you're going to say, oh, we got to go back and look and find these things. We're going to be popping them up right now. If you've got a subscription to it, it's free. You can, you know, it'll be there for you. It'll just go and, you know, it'll be up there. So whatever you're listening to, we appreciate it. If you can leave a 5-star review, we'd love that. And be sure to tell a friend, of most of all. Check us out on Instagram and Twitter, and also on our Facebook. I'm still working on that one. And our website, onscreenandbeyond.com. I have not updated some of the latest ones that we have reposted. If you go to those and click on it, you're going to get a, you know, saying that it's not available or whatever. But I am going to be updating those. So we're just going to get things all worked out there. As I, you know, after my major computer crash, things are a little crazy right now. We're trying to get out all this other stuff. So we appreciate your patience. And a lot more episodes are coming your way. So get ready for that. So that's it for this episode. That's a wrap for this episode of On Screen and Beyond. So until next time, when we once again take you on screen and beyond, I'm Brian Zemrak. Take care.
Thank you.